to dictate that.
All right, Mr. Howell, you may proceed.
I have Mr. Dave Amos with the law firm of Jeff Peterson, representing that firm, Servell, Isaac, Peterson, and Levy, and this is Benjamin Perdue with our firm, the Eminent Domain Litigation Group. My name is Henry Howell. I'm here from Alva Bailey, a widow from Dixon County, who is the fee owner of acreage in Dixon County, under which mines are taking place for coal under permits. This is on a certified question that you accepted from the Eastern District Court, Judge Payne, asking for you to decide whether the 1981 Act creating a presumption relating to severance deeds applies to all the severance deeds that existed as of 1981 and into the future.
Mr. Howell, look, can I ask you a hypothetical? Suppose the mine void statute was never enacted. It was never a 1981 statute. And suppose this court reviewed Claiborne and said, you know, it was wrong then, and it's still wrong, and we reversed it. Just hypothetically suppose those things. Wouldn't the court have the authority, may not be good judgment from your perspective, wouldn't the court have the authority to take Claiborne off the book since it was simply a judicial interpretation?
No, Your Honor. It doesn't matter which branch of government takes property, either by judicial decision or otherwise, according to the plurality of the Stop Beach Renourishment case of the Supreme Court that said what the legislature can do, a court also, what the legislature cannot do by legislative act to effect a taking, a court of that same state cannot do it. It doesn't matter which branch of government.
So you have a constitutional right to an interpretive presumption of a deed?
Well, that's the issue of what Claiborne is. Is it just a presumption, or was it establishing what are property rights, which they called identifying what the coal interest owner, coal estate owner, had a corporeal hereditament in the coal and an incorporeal hereditament in the right to remove the coal.
But the thing I don't understand is, in 1920, this court said that its ruling in Claiborne was contrary to an unbroken line of judicial decisions throughout the entirety of, according to them, English common law interpretations as well as other states. They said, we freely admit that the numerous and practically all other opposing views are contrary to their ruling. But if I understand the logic of your argument, we don't have the authority to revisit an opinion that we said was an aberration when we gave it. I just find that unusual. I don't know what to make of it.
Yes. Well, Claiborne wasn't a presumption as it's being characterized. It was a definition of the common law of property rights in Virginia. And no Virginia case was on point at that. They said, we are departing from other jurisdictions. And if you read Claiborne, which is extremely arduous to read, it's so old in 1920, and to make it through it, I mean, to have to find out what a corporeal hereditament is versus an incorporeal hereditament is a challenge. But they established a common law in Virginia that departed from an analysis of long cases in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, and they said, we find no logic to their analysis of the common law of property rights as it applies to mine voids. We are going to determine what property rights are in Virginia, and we are going to determine that mine voids, by virtue of these broad deeds, do not are not owned afterwards, and they use the term property rights and ownership, not a presumption. The word presumption doesn't occur in Claiborne. It says mine voids are owned. Why? Because they analyze a severance deed. And a severance deed is simply the right to get the mine and carry the coal and get it away. It's a ownership of the coal, and whether implied or expressed, an easement is attached to that coal to get it out. As soon as the coal is severed, it becomes personalty once it's carried away. So they said because coal is personalty, and there's nothing in it, because if you own the mine voids, you'd own the strata above, and you'd own the strata above, below. Not coal, the strata itself.
Claiborne inferred an easement, which is a property interest, as you point out, from silent language of an express deed that only conveyed expressly the mineral rights.
No, Your Honor. Claiborne determined that when there is a transfer of title by a severance deed in the coal, then the coal is given, and attached to the coal, whether expressed or implied, is an easement. An easement, which they called an incorporeal hereditament, which simply means an heir can inherit this particular type of property, I found out, and looking at cases back to the 1700s. But so that easement attaches to it, which is, we know, a contract of sorts, just to get the coal out. And when the coal is gone, all of the estate is gone. And the easement that came with it to get it out is gone. That's Claiborne. It established private property rights in Virginia as of 1920. Well, they said that's what existed all the time in Virginia from the beginning. Of course, they were mainly considered these severance deeds of all these northerners who came down, these people in the Appalachia, and bought all these mineral rights for pennies on the dollar. And that all started in the 80s and 90s. So there was quite a bit of opportunity for the Supreme Court to wade into it. But they didn't wade into it until 1920. And they said the law in Virginia has always been, the property law in Virginia, is that coal is when you title coal, you get the coal, and whether expressed or implied, the right to get it out, once it's gone, all your ownership is gone.
Counsel.
That's what Claiborne said.
Claiborne is rather interesting.
Your Honor, excuse me?
Claiborne is rather interesting, in part because the court began by interpreting a deed and ended up essentially with a declaration of policy. But my curiosity is this. Rather than looking at what our court might do today if we were to revisit Claiborne, could Camilla Red Ash Coal Company, the losing party in Claiborne, have made a colorable argument to the U.S. Supreme Court after that 1920 decision based upon the takings clause of the federal Constitution?
Well, under Stop the Beach Renourishment case out of Florida that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, they would if it was a change in the common law of property rights. It was not a change in any common law in Virginia as of 1920. The court in Claiborne expressly said, we have not visited this. We know all the other decisions and all the other cases. We're going to look at them closely, and they did. And they distinguished them and said, we just can't agree with the inherent logical contradictions within those decisions to go along with it.
Well, Mr. Howell, before your time expires,
yes,
want to get to the statute?
Thank you. Yes, as interesting as all these are, God, when I filed this thing in state court, I thought it'd be simple. Before Mr. Spangler thought he'd get a fair hearing in federal court, we removed it, and then alleged we had no standing because the 1981 Act had taken all our rights. Of course, you can't remove the case in federal court if the person doesn't have standing, because then it gets dismissed, and you end up paying other person's attorney's fees for the removal action. But there we are with LaVisa that didn't expressly deal with the statute. And then we had Judge Moore in Russell County say, my word, severance deeds aren't contracts and agreements. They can't be. They have no meaning. I'm going to take judicial notice that all the severance deeds are before 1981. And I'm going to take judicial notice, because there was no evidence, that this will have no effect whatsoever if I don't reach the conclusion a deed is not a contract. A severance deed is not a contract. I think we can all agree a deed is always a contract or agreement. Not all contracts and agreements are deeds. But a deed, especially a severance deed, that Claiborne, in referring to a New York case, an Illinois case dealing with severance contracts, refers to them as contracts. Claiborne refers to severance deeds as contracts. So if you're dealing with Claiborne, and they're referring to other decisions in other states that the coal industry thinks is wonderful, and we got it wrong in Virginia in 1920, then you know the whole case. I mean,
did you say that Claiborne characterized the severance deed as a contract?
Characterized the severance deeds involved in the Illinois case and the New York case as contracts. If you read the Illinois cases that they referred to in Consolidated Coal, Your Honor, you'll see that if you go back to those two cases, which is Consolidated Coal and St. Louis versus Schmizer, and Gennett versus...
Are there any Virginia cases that say deeds as a matter of law are understood to be contractual for purposes of the common law of contract?
Yes, Your Honor. We cited some cases that the deed is the highest form of agreement and contract. It has an elevated status, yes. There are numerous, under the merger doctrine, all the agreements beforehand merge, and the deed is the ultimate contract. Yes, we cited authorities that hold that deeds are contracts, Your Honor, and it's the Empire case and a whole slew of ones that, applying the merger doctrine, refer to the deed as the ultimate contract, merging everything into it.
And well, so, Mr. Howe, why did the General Assembly include contract language in the amendments to 154?
In 1981 or 2012? In 1980, of course, I'm challenging the 2012 Act, not the 1981 Act, and that's all in federal court. But in 1981, they said instruments dealing with mineral rights. Then they say any deeds by which a mineral owner acquires title, there shall be a presumption that the mine boards, if not, if the deed is otherwise silent, are owned by the mineral estate owners. And then it has a grandfathering provision that says it doesn't affect any agreements or contracts. Now, obviously, a deed is an agreement, but there are agreements that flow out of that deed, like how much are you going to charge me to get through my mine boards after you exhausted the coal? How much?
Well, why would they talk about deeds in one part of the paragraph and contracts in the other part?
Because they wanted the grandfathering to be comprehensive, because deeds, number one, they're not deeds, right? We're talking about severance deeds. It's a transfer of title, but it's a special class of deed where they're ongoing agreements, because there's an ongoing easement and a need to support. There's ongoing contractual relationship in severance deeds. And they say it's deeds relating to mineral estates, which are severance deeds, and everyone relates to severance deeds. So we're dealing with a special animal of severance deeds, but whatever, a deed is a contract. Why did they say deeds? Because, and everyone's those referring to those deeds as severance deeds, not real estate deeds, not land deeds, everyone, severance deeds. I got 51 seconds here. They're deeds, but look, are all deeds contracts? Yes, please. Are all contracts deeds? No. It is that simple. And I've wasted 15 minutes of your time to get to that point. Thank you.
30 seconds remaining. Mr. Groove.
May it please the Court. Matt Gooch here for Conrad Spangler. have to start off talking about deeds and contracts. Maybe take a half a step back. The question before the court, the actual certified question, is a straightforward one of what does this statute mean? Does it apply to pre-1981 deeds? That's the question the federal district court has asked. And this discussion that sort of led off with was about constitutional concerns. This has to do with the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, and essentially it's kind of a bootstrapping of constitutional concerns about this statute to say that the court should read it a different way. But this court has held a number of times that you don't invoke the doctrine of constitutional avoidance or any of those doctrines where the language of the statute is clear. Here you have a very plain statute telling you, I'm telling the court, that deeds are not contracts. It's explaining on its own face the difference between these two things.
Where does it say that deeds aren't contracts?
Justice Williams, in the first sentence, it says, it provides for how deeds will be handled. Mm-hmm. And it says, unless otherwise provided for in the deed. In the third sentence, it says, nothing herein or nothing in this section shall be construed to affect existing contractual obligations or agreements.
Don't you agree that a deed is a subset of contractual agreement, contractual obligations or agreements?
Well, I think it matters who you ask. It's not, so there are a couple of cases
I just asked you. Is a deed a subset of a contractual obligation?
In the extraordinary sense, you could say yes. You could find, you know, in the arcane legal sense, perhaps, but not in the common sense. No one understands them to be the same two things. Anyone who's ever bought a house before knows that you have a contract and you have a deed, and the actual deed is what passes title, but you still need a contract. More importantly than that is...
Contract merges into the deed, does it not?
Of course. So, I mean, that tells you that they're separate things.
And there's an agreement that will occur. Is that correct? But let me get to something else. Let's look at that last sentence.
Sure.
That last sentence is similar to language that the Office of the Attorney General suggests rather frequently when there is a potential constitutional question of retroactivity. Is it not?
That's fair. Correct.
Did the Office of the Attorney General suggest the language in this 1981 case?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. But when the Office of the Attorney General suggests such language, it's generally boilerplate of that nature, is it not?
Sure.
And this appears to be very, very much that sort of boilerplate.
Right. You can find this kind of language in other parts of the code.
That's what I mean. Thank you.
But again, if you read what that, in terms of what that language does, is it cures constitutional concerns about contracts. It's saying that this subsection is not going to impair existing contracts. So if a landowner has a wheelage contract with a coal company, this subsection isn't going to zap it. It will still have contractual effect. A deed is a different animal. The General Assembly...
Have there been any constitutional cases where the impairment to contract prohibition has been applied to interpretive rules with property deeds? In other words, has any federal court or state court, for that matter, interpreted a real property deed or a mineral deed or a severance deed or anything of a kind to be in the quality of a contract for purposes of the impairment, the contract prohibition in the Constitution?
I do not know the answer to that. The key question is, what did the General Assembly understand about these two words? It uses them separately, it handles them separately in two different titles, and it calls them different things and uses them separately here on the plain face of the statute. It's not using them interchangeably. You know, in the arcane legal sense, one could say that a deed is an extraordinary form of contract, but that's not the General Assembly's understanding when you read the subsection.
After Claiborne, did Mrs. Which one is your client? After Claiborne, did Mrs. Bailey's predecessor own the mine boy?
Well, you would look at her deed, and in this particular deed, no, she would not own the mine boy. based on...
Didn't Claiborne say she owned the mine?
The Claiborne said that, and the actual holding in Claiborne is that there's a presumption where a deed is silent. So the actual holding is, when nothing more is said, then the coal is granted, or that the coal is granted with the right to mine or remove it, nothing but the coal and the right to remove it ought to be understood to pass by the deed. So the court is saying this is an interpretive rule. It's not creating a property right. So she didn't...
So after Claiborne, who owned the mine void? That's that question here.
The surface owner would have a interest in the mine void under that interpretive rule.
And so under your theory of the case, if the surface owner owned the mine void after Claiborne, how then does the statute divest them of that ownership?
Well, the statute, Claiborne and the statute, neither one create an actual stick in the property bundle of rights. Claiborne is creates an inference about who owns it. But I think as Justice Kelsey has referred to, the court could revisit that precedent and overturn it within the bounds of Stop the Beach. It's not an actual property right.
Okay, counsel, let's bear down on that for a moment. In 1887, Sutherland granted the mineral rights but remained the surface owner.
Right.
Correct. From 1887 until 1920, there was never any question with regard to this property. In 1920, Claiborne decision interpreted all of those deeds, including the Sutherland deed, as number one, you retain the mine void, and number two, once there's no more coal to where there's an easement for the support of the mine. But once there's no more coal, even that easement goes away. Do I interpret Claiborne correctly?
That's right.
Now, in this particular instance, the Sutherland deed from 1987, that property stayed within the Sutherland family for 96 years, did it not? It was a Sutherland who, there's no other deeds in the record, but it was a Sutherland who was the grantor to Bailey.
We can assume that that's the case for the question, sure.
So
I don't know that there's
a grandchild or a great grandchild,
right.
But there's no other deeds out and then back into the Sutherland. So the rights that Claiborne gave by interpreting the 1887 deed were never expanded or contracted prior to 1981. How do you argue that those are not vested rights based upon that determination?
The best you could say is that they are inchoate rights. A rogue court decision that goes against all the precedents.
You're saying
is
the
not
Virginia Supreme Court is rogue?
Of course not, Your Honor. I'm not trying to be funny. But it was certainly the only jurisdiction that made that holding. A court decision doesn't create, that court decision didn't create an actual property right. The Sutherlands could have entered into a contract with the coal operator at that time and created some contractual rights or property rights to a contract. But the fact that there is a court decision out there doesn't mean that the court decision will never change. It's subject to being revisited, to being overturned. In fact, there was a dissent in Claiborne. So anyone who looked at the Claiborne case after 1920 didn't necessarily have a vested property right. They had the benefit of an interpretive rule that gave them an ownership presumption.
How do you ever then determine who owns the property? What I hear you saying is the Supreme Court makes a decision, but the surface owners don't own the property. Now the General Assembly has made a retroactive decision that you're saying now indicates the mine void. The coal owner owns the mine void. If we find this legislation unconstitutional, then it would go back to the surface owner. I'm not sure how one would ever have a vested right in property if it changes with the court decision and the General Assembly and back to the court decision? Is there never a finality as to who owns it? How does that happen?
With respect to mine boards, it happens through the parties coming into an agreement. So parties who have...
But these mine voids are there, Mr. Gooch. They've been right there now for hundreds of years. I don't think they'll probably make any more, according to what we've read here. So there is an existing mine void. What finally determines who owns it? The contracts are already entered into. The deeds are already done.
Under the statute, the coal company is the presumptive owner of that void for the uses enumerated in the statute. But again, that's not a, it's not creating a new property interest. It's just, it's creating a way of inferring things or interpreting a deed between these parties. Nothing was taken from surface owners in 1981.
Can I ask you a hypothetical? Suppose there's a contract, not a super contract deed that's being argued here, but a real contract, an employment agreement, employer contracting with an employee, has a covenant not to compete in it. And let's say a high court says the covenant not to compete is enforceable. Can't the court later say, you know, we made a mistake, actually it's not enforceable? And could anybody reply to that by saying, no, I have a contractual right under the impairment of contracts clause to the prior interpretation, you're not allowed to change your mind?
Of course the court can change its mind.
And in fact, we did in Paramount, did we not, Paramount Pest Control, we did exactly that. So how is it that this court opinion in 1920 was in perpetuity for all of our lives completely sacrosanct from any review, either by a court or a legislature or any other unit of government? What is the authority for that proposition?
There isn't any. I mean, Stop the Beach is the only authority they've cited for the problem changing state law. But this doesn't, we're not talking about taking
away. Well, Counsel, maybe I'm missing something, but what difference does it make about Claiborne now that we have the statute?
Your Honor, I don't follow you.
Well, maybe I'm not following things either. The statute clearly modifies Claiborne,
yes,
does it not? So why are we spending all this time arguing about Claiborne? Question is, what is the effect of that statute on the ownership of these voids? Isn't it?
I think so.
What's the answer to it?
The answer is that the statute applies to all deeds that don't have provisions in there for use of mine voids, and that under the statute, Justice Koontz, that the coal owner is the presumptive owner for the enumerated uses of the void. That it provides the answer in the statute. The coal owner can use it. The parties aren't going to provide otherwise. So there's not a... Again, the language of the actual statute is clear.
May I ask you one last question?
Sure, of course.
Did Judge Payne certify to us the con law issue, or did Judge Payne only certify to us the state law interpretation of a state piece of legislation?
Judge Payne's question was the application of the statute.
So with the exception of the constitutional avoidance canon of construction of statutes, do you understand the scope of the reference to us to include a decision on whether or not this is a constitutional statute?
Absolutely not. The question doesn't ask that, and in fact, even if the court were concerned about the constitutionality of the statute, it doesn't really matter for the purposes of the certified question. The question is, what does the statute say?
We can restate a certified question, can we not?
Absolutely, Your Honor, you could. But if the court is to answer Judge Payne's question, the answer is this statute applies to all deeds. And the only way you get into the constitutional issues is through this constitutional avoidance problem, which really isn't an issue given the plain language of the statute.
I think what you're saying is that the interpretive rule that was articulated by the Supreme Court of Virginia in 1920 created an inchoate right. But in order to vest that right, you probably need some type of a court action, right? And so if you filed a lawsuit for 1981, certainly Claiborne would decide what your rights were at that point in time, and it would be vested because of that lawsuit. But if you didn't, aren't you going to take whatever the law is when you file to try to figure out what your rights are?
I see I'm out of time. You would need to do something to vest your rights, because the court could revisit and change the precedent, or the legislature could. I think the way to vest it is actually to enter into a contract with the coal company. And at that point, you have vested contractual rights. There's nothing vested about an interpretive rule of court.
Are you saying an interpretive rule did not vest any rights in anybody?
Exactly. Thank you.
All right, your time has expired. Mr. Howell, you have 30 seconds.
Please read La Vista. La Vista said in Claiborne, interpreting Claiborne, we were required to determine as a matter of first impression in Virginia whether a trespass had occurred against the rights of the owner of the surface estate. Trespass property law. Answering your question, can you change it? Property rights. Property rights. Not contract, nothing else. Property rights. It would be absurd to allow a state to do by judicial decree what the takings clause forbids it to do by legislative fiat. That's the United States Supreme Court. If you're changing property rights law, yes, it's a taking. Thank you.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.